Sharon Packer, an EMT and nuclear engineer, is president of the American Civil Defense Association. Paul Seifried is president of Utah Shelter Systems. Their presentation is titled, Civil Defense, Anachronism or Wave of the Future.
Soon after the 9/11 crisis, Oprah Winfrey interviewed Laura Bush on television, and Oprah asked her, "What did you tell your children during that crisis to comfort them?" And Laura Bush said, "I told them their father had been taken to a safe place, and they would be taken to a safe place too." The question that immediately formed in my mind was, where is the safe place for my children? Most Americans are unaware that high-ranking government officials and critical mission personnel are provided protection through a program called Continuity of Government. They and many of their family members have access to hardened MVC shelters. My family members are my critical mission personnel. Do we consider our government leaders more important than our own children? Or, in view of the events of the last 50 years, does the public no longer need a civil defense system? Are we less vulnerable now than we were during the Cold War era? Is civil defense a relic of the past? I'd like to give you a brief summary of events that brought civil defense to the position it holds today, and to tell you why we believe civil defense can and must become a wave of the future. The dictionary defines civil defense as a range of emergency measures to be taken by an organized body of civilian volunteers for the protection of life and property in the event of natural disaster or enemy attack. We think this definition is, as currently shown in the dictionary, is a relic of the past, and Paul will later show you a new definition for civil defense. In 1945, with the detonation of atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, civil defense took on new intensity. In 1948, President Truman was busy with the first battle of the Cold War, the Berlin Airlift. For several days, the world teetered on the brink of another European war. In 1949, the USSR tested a nuclear weapon, and the weapons race began. People consciously or unconsciously did a risk assessment. What was the probability that nuclear war would affect them personally? What were the consequences if this were to happen? The threat was in Europe. It was a long ways away. Both probability and consequences of a nuclear war in the United States were perceived as being very low in the minds of the U.S. population. In the 50s, the nuclear ranks were swelled to include England. The official nuclear policy of the United States, as coined by President Eisenhower, was one of massive retaliation, which called for massive nuclear attack against the Soviet Union if they were to attack Europe. In 1952, under the direction of Edward Teller, the first hydrogen bomb was tested. This bomb was a momentous breakthrough, fusing isotopes of hydrogen and initiating further fission reactions. Just a few months later, to our surprise, Russia detonated their own H-bomb. The threat became larger, the fuse smaller. The hydrogen bomb was front page news. Fallout shelters were designated. Civil defense skills were taught to all school-aged children. FEMA published home shelter plans, and public fallout shelters were stocked. Bert the Turtle became a common household name. Some of you may remember this film strip.
Dum, 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 dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He ducked and covered, ducked and covered. He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you
ducked and covered.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover.
Wasn't that great? If any of you would like a copy of that film strip, we have the full 9.5 minutes on a CD, so please see us afterwards if you'd like that. Would this advice be well taken today? Or is Bert the Turtle a relic of the past? I actually think the advice of Bert the Turtle to duck and cover was good, solid doctrine. This could have provided survival and limited injury for people in the 1 to 2 PSI range, giving time for them to enter their existing public fallout shelters. If today we had existing public shelters in place, we too would need such a creative tool to teach this concept to our children. In 1957, the Soviets placed the first artificial satellite into orbit. Sputnik marked the start of the space race. America soon developed and deployed nuclear warheads on the long arms of the ICBMs. In the 60s, with the advent of ballistic missile submarines, it became apparent that the U.S. and the USSR could effectively survive a first nuclear strike and retaliate with a second nuclear strike. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara coined the concept of mutual assured destruction, better known as MAD. This unofficial policy of deterrence through mutual assured destruction drove many of our government's policies and decisions. Civil defense was labeled as immoral. And in light of this policy, and civil defense with its goal of survival was the antithesis of MAD. As a result, civil defense lost its funding. In October 1962, we experienced the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev conceived the idea of placing intermediate range missiles in Cuba just 90 miles off the coast of the U.S. Some say this was the closest the world ever came to having a nuclear war. President Kennedy came before the public and solemnly explained the situation. The crisis took headlines in every newspaper. The general public became aware of the immensity of the threat, and they spontaneously started building their own personal bomb shelters from commercial companies. The American public did a new risk assessment. Now, the probability of nuclear war on our homeland became a reality. The potential consequences of nuclear exchange were unthinkable. Our vulnerability was unparalleled. Public civil defense was now on track, but it was short-lived and people soon forgot. By the end of that decade, two more countries, France and China, had tested nuclear weapons. The threat became larger and the fuse smaller. In the 70s, an additional four countries were added to the nuclear club. Developing regional states with their adversaries brought the potential to bring the U.S. and the USSR into their conflicts. The proliferation of nuclear weapons became a critical issue. The large number of countries with nuclear capability, some of which had remarkably irresponsible leadership, shortened the length of the fuse by automatically increasing the potential for a nuclear exchange. In the 80s and 90s, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, several Soviet satellite countries inherited nuclear weapons. They later gave up the weapons, but the Ukraine now admits that because of accounting errors, they still have several hundred nuclear warheads. I wonder how many other countries have committed accounting errors. In that decade, South Africa and Pakistan tested weapons, and Iran and Iraq expressed full intentions to go nuclear. President Reagan very wisely attempted to destroy the MAD concept with the development of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI. Both civil defense and missile defense had a small resurgence, but that was soon destroyed by the next administration. Civil defense was on a roller coaster. In 2001, during and immediately after the 9/11 crisis, our phones never stopped ringing. People frantically asked, "Where is my nearest public civil defense shelter?" We regretfully answered, "There are no public civil defense shelters in your area, and there are no civil defense shelters in any other area." They were astounded and perplexed and frustrated, and ultimately they were angry. Many people, as they did during the Cuban Missile Crisis, spontaneously began building their own personal private shelters. Preparedness companies had a great year. Now, just 4 years later, our phones have stopped ringing. There's seldom anything in the headlines that brings them to that 9/11 level of activity. Their eyes have glazed over. How can this have happened? In light of the fact that between 2000 and 2005, India, Israel, and North Korea claimed to have nuclear weapons, and seven terrorist nations and 28 terrorist organizations have been openly acknowledged by our government as being a national threat with either nuclear or suspected chemical biological capabilities. Can we still say that the Cuban Missile Crisis brought the world the closest to nuclear war? In light of the colossal number of nations and organizations threatening our borders, I would say our risk today, with the probability of intentional or accidental use, multiplied by the consequence factor of tens of millions of casualties, has brought us closer to the greatest threat level we have ever experienced. Are we such sheep that we must have headlines and public announcements in order to see the threat? The threat has become unbelievably large. The fuse is almost non-existent. There's no way to retaliate against a terrorist organization that has no country. We no longer have mutual assured destruction as deterrence. MAD is dead. And we have no protection for our citizens. We live in the greatest country in the world. But this world has become a dangerous place in which to live. Some of you may remember the Edward Teller quote. He said, "In a dangerous situation, we have chosen the most dangerous of courses. We have chosen not to face our danger." We must take it upon ourselves to educate our government that civil defense is needed and wanted. We live in a representative form of government. Why are we not asking, even demanding, civil defense protection for our families? Could it be that we ourselves are at fault for this lack of a national shelter program? Civil defense must become a wave of the future. Through the past 50 years, we have seen and experienced many changes in our country's resolve and overall vision related to the defense of the civilian population. The current Department of Homeland Security was not designed to take the place of a civil defense program. Nationally, the DDP and the American Civil Defense Association, or TACTA, stand alone in their efforts to keep the concept of a civilian civil defense alive. As the current president of TACTA, I invite you to join us in our efforts to bring civil defense into the 21st century and to make civil defense a wave of the future. TACTA has a vision, we have a plan, and we have tools to help us with this endeavor. We have a wonderful board of directors who work tirelessly, writing articles for the journal, keeping us aware of current events, and providing motivation and encouragement. We have two new members of our team, George Levitt, our dynamic new executive director, and Trey Edwards, who does our layouts and our visuals. They understand our vision and have helped us redefine and sharpen our mission statement. Our bi-monthly journal focuses on threats from both natural and man-made disaster. Survival of weapons of mass destruction, however, is our main thrust. Our journal is designed to educate the American civilian base to the threats that we face as a country and to offer practical strategies and solutions to enable them to prepare for and mitigate these threats. Every article in our journal is designed to follow our STOP concept, to encourage our members to study, think, observe, and then finally to prepare. Our website, TACTA.org, is another great tool. It features many of our lessons and ideas from our journal. In addition to this, material will soon be offering online classes for a TACTA Academy in civil defense issues. We'll offer beginning through advanced levels with tests and graduation certificates. And please note in our, we have a TACTA store, and this is a store that we use in order to fund our organization. It offers a variety of emergency items, and we also sell what we call MET tags. And this is a triage tag that we sell to hospitals, fire departments, EMTs, and other emergency response teams. The TAPTA team originated the medical emergency triage tag concept. MET tag remains the leader in this industry, featuring identification tags, chemical biological contamination tags, ER, and our best-selling M137 basic disaster tag. The most powerful of all of our tools is our TAPTA membership. We hope to build our membership base with motivated and inspired citizens who will work with us to influence state and federal legislation. And we currently have three legislative goals. First, we are in the process of setting engineering standards for shelter construction, standards that we hope will be accepted on a federal level. We plan to encourage all shelter manufacturing companies to follow these guidelines. This information will repeatedly be published in our Journal of Civil Defense. We'll be using engineering concepts that have been taught to us by our mentors. We remember with fondness and gratitude the efforts of Edward Teller, Ed York, Cresson Kearney, and others who have tirelessly researched and tested the correct methods for shelter construction. And we give special thanks to Art Robinson for his efforts in obtaining FEMA funds and for funded shelter displays that have influenced more people in nuclear preparedness than any effort to date. And we hope to resurrect this program and put these shelter displays into their intended use. Our next goal will be to seek tax deductions for our shelters and other preparations. And finally, we hope to be instrumental in acquiring a nationally funded shelter program for every U.S. citizen. Now, that may sound a bit ambitious, but to us, we believe this goal is reachable. Nevertheless, don't wait to start your shelter program until we get a national shelter program. We're encouraging our members to join with friends and neighbors in forming chapters throughout the nation. There are many advantages to becoming a TACTA chapter. We hope that TACTA will become the national vehicle to bring information on civil defense issues to the general public. As a chapter member, you will have access to a speakers bureau, videos, transparencies, lesson plans, and slide presentations. You'll be able to contact families that have actually built and stocked shelters and have the benefit of their wide and varied experiences. You'll have the companionship of like-minded people, which brings both comfort and synergism to your defense efforts. And so through this TACTA chapter program, you will be teaching others in your area the things that we have taught you. We're using the Civil Defense Volunteers of Utah as a model for our chapter concept. Over the past 15 years, the Civil Defense Volunteers of Utah have been teaching critical civil defense information to their members. And we'd like to thank Jay Wimpey, the current president of Civil Defense Volunteers, and his volunteers for their generous help in reviewing and developing the lesson materials and other chapter concepts. We now have 12 lessons we're readying and reviewing for chapter use. We want to teach nuclear weapons effects to everyone. They need to understand the thermal and the blast and radiation. They need to understand the teaching of shielding concepts and radiation decay and penalty charts and radiological monitoring. We'll teach about the electromagnetic pulse. People need to know the devastating effects of an EMP and the potential and consequences for long-term power outage. Some of you may remember Lowell Wood talking a couple of years ago and suggesting that if we turned off our power for a period of 1 year, that probably half the population would die. This EMP problem has driven the development of most of our lesson plans. People need to know how to deal with the reality of having no gas for their vehicles, no heat for their homes, no food in the stores, no lights, no television. That can't be all bad. No fuel for cooking, no telephone systems, no open pharmacies or doctor offices. We would become a third world country in less than a day. And so our 12 lesson plans teach us how to deal with each of these contingencies. Our second plan deals with chemical biological terrorism, and we certainly need more than duct tape and plastic to deal with that threat. People need to know the importance of having the ability to self-quarantine. They need to be prepared to survive within the perimeters of their own home for as long a period as possible. TACTA recommends that every person put away at least a year's supply of food and other supplies. We have a lesson on food preparation and storage. We'll teach them brand new concepts about eating, what they would do in the event of a nuclear attack, and how they would eat properly, why they would eat trout instead of catfish, why they can eat meat and not the soup from the animals they might slaughter, how they would cook without electricity. We also teach about natural disaster, before, after, and during the crises of earthquake, tornado, hurricane, winter storms. And then we stress, if you are prepared and sheltered for nuclear, you are prepared for all of those things. We teach about water storage, how to prepare your containers, and how you properly filter and purify water that you have had to go and find. We teach about first aid, basic concepts of ABCs that need continual review, plus with the addition of the treatment of radiation sickness and thermal burns. We teach all-hazard sheltering construction concepts, the appropriate building materials, concrete, corrugated steel and steel plate, the importance of small diameter entrances with 90-degree turns, the proper installation procedures, ventilation requirements, and supplies. Few of you probably realize that a 90-degree turn in your entrance will attenuate 90% of the gamma radiation. And a 10-foot horizontal run will attenuate almost all of the other 10%. So that vertical and horizontal run becomes very important. And the horizontal run also gives you the ability to shelter against initial radiation, against the neutrons and the prompt gammas, because the shelters that we're proposing will survive at a quarter mile from the crater edge of a 1 megaton weapon. That's at 200 PSI. And they have been tested to that PSI. And so within that range, you are within that initial radiation range of a 1.5 mile radius. Expedient sheltering, how to find temporary shelter if caught away from your home, and how to construct a temporary shelter in an escalating crisis. Then we'll talk about post-war survival, decontamination methods for living areas and for your food, how to decontaminate potatoes and carrots and apples and all of those things that may have fallout on them. People don't believe they can eat that food, and they certainly can. And the reasons you can't eat strawberries and raspberries that have been contaminated. We teach them about living without electricity. We teach them cold weather survival and the concepts of Jim Phillips' method of making clothing with open cell foam. Gardening techniques, how to clear fallout from the garden spots, which foods can be safely planted and harvested, and the importance of storing non-hybrid seeds. Emergency communications, what types of radios to purchase, and amateur radio training. The importance of buying 40-80 meter frequency ham radios, because they don't require a relay station, where the 2 meters will be no more valuable to us than a CB would be. Alternative power sources, choosing the proper generators, managing lead acid batteries, water generators, and solar power. And the importance of limiting our consumption of power to only very low amperage lighting and communication. We'll not use our power to heat our homes or cool our homes or cook our food. Preparing neighbors to help neighbors. Utilizing the experience and knowledge base of large groups of people. Helping the single moms and the elderly and the handicapped or sick to deal with and prepare with the unthinkable problems of large-scale emergencies. We invite you to join TACTA and hope you will find your membership to be a fulfilling, rewarding, and beneficial experience. We're offering our memberships at a discounted rate right now, so we hope you will visit our executive director, George, out at his table and take advantage of this offer to our DDP friends. We talked a few minutes ago about the $1,000 donation that you're all so willing to give. What can you do with $1,000 for sheltering? For less than $1,000, you can have a sheltered place in a hardened MBC shelter in your home installed, in your home area. All of our membership dues and donations, as well as profits from our store, go to funding our lofty mission. We have a small paid staff, and none of the board members or officers receive a salary or other compensation. You receive all of these things with our journal for $36 a year, or with our discount. Can't remember just what the discount was, but for around $30 a year, you can receive all of these items. We want members. We want to teach you how to survive. Civil defense must become a wave of the future. If it does not, we not only risk our lives, but we could be risking our very sovereignty. So please contact us. And Paul Seyfried, is now going to discuss what the rest of the world has been doing while we've been doing nothing in civil defense. And in light of the fact that America does not have a nationally funded shelter program, we will explore what you personally can do to protect your families with a well-designed shelter place.
Appreciate the opportunity to come before the DDP and present. Let's go over the next one, Trey. I love this cartoon. We dug that out of a recent TACTA journal. About 3 weeks ago, I was in the lunchroom at work and picked up a newspaper at USA Today, June 23rd, not even a month old yet. And, of course, you can see the priorities of the nation on this page. In the upper right-hand corner, we have a tattoo-smeared rap artist. On the left corner, we have our athletic gods that we worship, and we have the title here. The main column of interest is Congress Muscle Shapes Steroid Debate. So we're very concerned about steroid use in our athletes. And, of course, the airlines are increasing their airfares. And then, of course, if you open it up to page 6A, in a tiny little 8-line paragraph, which we've inserted here, says, Senate panel assesses attack risks. The world faces a 50% chance of an attack using weapons of mass destruction over the next 5 years, and a 70% chance over the next decade, according to 85 national security experts surveyed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Its report said the risks of biological or chemical attacks were at least as high as the risk of a nuclear attack. I wonder which of these articles would be of most importance to the nation. Okay, but we put WMD attack on, you know, a little page in the back. So that could be part of the problem, not only with our population, but with our government officials that are charged with defending the nation from attack. Let's go with the next one. A few years ago, Elizabeth Farah, who owns or is part owner in the WorldNet Daily, gave a magnificent speech at the luncheon on civil defense, and most of you probably remember that speech, as she's a real spark plug on this issue. And, of course, when Sharon and I see something that is truly outstanding in its execution, we like to rip it off and use it in the work that we do. And so, as compared to the dictionary definition of civil defense earlier, for those of you who can't read all of that, she defines civil defense as a nationwide system of blast and fallout shelters outfitted with equipment and supplies necessary for civilian survival in the event of nuclear, biological, or chemical attack by any enemy, whether a terrorist organization, traitorous organization, or foreign military. Civil defense is not a response by government agencies after an attack. Civil defense is not a plan for evacuation. It is a defense function of the federal government requiring a system of shelters as its foundational component. The U.S. government at one time had a rudimentary civil defense program complete with facilities, a budget, directors, and staff who are quite knowledgeable about weapons effects and protective measures. American Civil Defense had a clear mission and was very focused on protecting the citizenry from attack. The U.S. effort never achieved the level of sophistication that Switzerland did, but it was an effort nonetheless, inasmuch as these people who were involved in this effort have long since retired or are deceased, the attack preparedness culture within our government has largely been lost. In the last quarter century, the government has abandoned the original intent of civil defense in favor of emergency management, which focuses on hurricanes, wildfires, earthquakes, similar things. Attack preparedness rates only as casual mention, is far behind the disasters I just mentioned. Emergency management staff at the federal and state level are by now mostly clueless on the effects of NBC weaponry and the proper equipment and procedures needed to protect the citizens. This may also contribute to a lack of enthusiasm on the part of officials to push for a more rigorous attack preparedness culture at the higher levels of government. Civil defense has become such an orphan child that even the current administration, while vigorously pushing for national missile defense, avoids making public the current status of the nuclear capabilities of our real enemies and adversaries and the total vulnerability of our civilian and military population. While the United States has been busy doing nothing in the area of civil defense, other countries in Europe and Asia are either maintaining their civil defense programs or are increasing spending in this area. Singapore, for example, has poured money into the construction of public shelters for at least a decade, and their efforts appear to be ongoing. I have no photographs from the Singapore effort, but we have some others from different places in the world we'll share with you in a minute. Sweden has been building shelters since before World War II and have hardened shelters available for about 60% of her urban population. New structures are required to build in hardened dual-use shelter areas. This is part of their building code. Sweden also enjoys a manufacturing base that can manufacture shelter components such as blast valves, air handling systems, armored doors, etc. They also employ Swiss hardware extensively in their constructions. Norway, Finland, and Denmark also have functioning civil defense offices and programs with varying degrees of emphasis between shelters and evacuation. But they have not devalued civil defense from its original mission, which is attack preparedness. Finland also has a homegrown shelter component manufacturing capability, something that is very lacking in the United States. In the Middle East, perhaps Israel leads the pack in shelter deployment and upgrades, converting older private and public shelters to meet current chemical and biological threats. Israel also manufactures shelter equipment, borrowing heavily from Swiss designs. Attack readiness is obviously a very high priority for them and is a critical component of their national defense. Upon invading Iraq, it was discovered that even Saddam had prepared a large number of public shelters for the Iraqi people. The U.S. media has filmed and photographed numerous examples of hardened shelters while covering events there. One can argue about the effectiveness of shelters and the marvels of U.S. precision bombing, but Saddam did in fact survive the numerous efforts by the Air Force to target and kill him in his extensive maze of underground facilities. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait began intensive shelter building campaigns in 1990, but little is known about how many were built, for whom, and whether shelter construction continues today. We do know that civil defense became a top priority when hostile action against that country was imminent. Russian civil defense is believed to continue after the so-called end of the Cold War, but may have experienced difficulties with budget cuts. The government has plowed billions of rubles into the construction of extremely hard, deep underground facilities and has lavished funds upgrading bunkers intended for the political elite. Two bunkers seem to be of continuing interest to our government, Yamantau and Kavinsky Mountain, are huge in scale and are capable of housing hundreds of thousands of the political elite. Yamantau Mountain is estimated to involve over 400 square miles of underground capacity, about the size of Washington, D.C. taking in inside the Beltway. The Russian government continues to deny the true purpose of this facility, having nearly a dozen alternative descriptions ready for Western investigators. They include mineral mining, archive storage, very interesting, clever descriptions. There are more than 200 similar very deep underground facilities that can handle perhaps more than 10,000 persons each of the politically connected. With the fall of the Soviet Union, Western observers can now view the shelters that were built in and around factories, apartment buildings, and universities. Some have even been converted to commercial enterprises such as nightclubs and restaurants, but can still offer protection in a crisis. Trey, let's go to the next one. These were photographs taken by Richard Ross, a professor from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he traveled extensively around the world to photograph shelters. And these photos were taken inside the Soviet subway system, built during the Stalin era, and the architecture is extremely interesting. Let's go with the next one. The subway trains, the subway stations and tunnels can provide very effective blast protection and fallout protection for perhaps millions of Soviet citizens living in urban areas. And the next slide will show us the armored doors that were installed in place. If you look down here by the near the end of the handrail, you'll see a sliding blast door there that can be deployed in a few minutes with little more than a screwdriver. You have to remove the railing, and then the blast door can be drawn across the entrance. The subway systems are also equipped with chemical and biological filtration systems and ventilation pumps and so forth. So this is a clever use of the underground space that they have in that country. The United States considered doing that in Washington, D.C. with the huge subway system deployed there, but of course as the completion of that subway proceeded, the plans for equipping it for as a shelter were killed. Let's go with another one. This photograph was taken inside a Russian nightclub that was converted from a shelter. You can see one of the interior doors there has been modified somewhat, but they still retain all of the armored doors and the air handling systems in the shelters. Mr. Ross had a great deal of trouble getting into the Russian shelters even today, and the Russian officials were pretty short with him in refusing his queries to tour various shelters. They just flatly denied him permission to do that. So if it wasn't a readily available converted facility, he either had to break in through a ventilation shaft and crawl down a couple of hundred feet of dirty, filthy ventilation shaft to get in there and set up and shoot, or he had to shoot something like this. Next slide. This is a photograph, several photographs taken during the Sino-Japanese War in the 1930s. The middle photograph is the one that I'm most focused on. Apparently, even while U.S. air power was in its infancy and the doctrine for the use of air power was still very much in a state of flux, the Chinese government still had the foresight to deploy underground air raid shelters. And Sharon and I have been emphasizing before the low priority of civil defense in this country, and perhaps before the shooting and the bombing started in China, civil defense may have not been in the forefront of the minds of the population. But in this tragic photograph, we see a part of the 4,000 people who were trampled to death at the entrance of the air raid shelters trying to get into the shelters at the commencement of an air raid. Let's go with the next one. This is a shelter built in China. It's in a small farming village. It was built to protect the local farmers in the area. And if you go down the stairs, you can see that it was quite extensive. And it's basically set up like a prairie dog community. And it has a number of entrances that come up through kitchens and warehouses and in barnyards and so forth. Many of the entrances are still covered with millstones. So they're. Let's go with the next one. This is the stairs that's descending down inside the tunnel. It's interesting that the earth in China is of a unique granular structure, and also Indochina, that allows tunneling without shoring. That is, the soil is able to support itself without a great deal of effort to, you know, prevent collapse, and lends itself readily to this type of architecture. Let's go with the next one. The Chinese now have several thousand miles of tunnels, and this, of course, is still the one that was built during World War II, and it's not designed to hold a lot of people, but like I said, this was built to protect farmers, so that we're not dealing with a heck of a lot of people here. But the next slide, I think, will show you the segments of the underground city in China. They have enough capacity in Beijing in these tunnels to house about 350,000 people, and I'm sure possibly more. You know, we pack these shelters beyond capacity. Let's go with another one. I have never seen these pictures of the underground city before. I've only read about them. But they still have the airtight doors. They have gas-resistant gaskets on the doors to prevent chemical weapons from entering. And they're all connected together in an amazing labyrinth of tunnels and crawlways. Let's go with another one. And some of them are decorated quite intricately, and today they sport barbershops and hospitals and restaurants. And, of course, there is also dormitory space available. Let's go with another one. Now, sometimes businesses are allowed to store things in various rooms in the underground city, but, of course, they would be required to remove that in the event of a gradually escalating crisis. Next slide. The influence of Mao Zedong is still present in China, and it was interesting to see his portrait still down there in the bowels of the system. Next slide. This is a World War II shelter built in Switzerland, and it's in the city of Vitznau. And this, interestingly, this complex rents space out to tourists who want to come spend a few days in a World War II shelter. And the balloons on the floor are from some recently departed Japanese tourists who had just had a big party, and apparently they had got their money's worth out of that. But let's go with another one. Yes. These are various public shelter entrances. The Swiss require the same kinds of components to be used on all shelter construction. Any shelter component used in the construction of a shelter must pass rigid government specifications as outlined by the Federal Office of Civil Defense, and every component has a certification tag riveted onto it that is issued by the BZS, or the Office of Civil Defense. Interestingly, these concrete doors will withstand the explosion of a 500-pound Mark 82 general-purpose bomb exploding only 4 yards away from the door. And they protect, of course, the door from direct effects by concealing these at the ends of long tunnels so that a fighter jet would never get a direct attack opportunity at the door itself. Let's go with another one. This is an individual who is the proud owner of a new private shelter. He's just built his house. He's exhibiting a VA-40 ventilation system there, and the Swiss citizens are allowed to store wine and furniture and other things in their bomb shelters in their basements, but of course they're required to make it ready within 12 hours' notice. The important thing is that the shelters are there and ready for use. Next slide. The two individuals in this slide are Hans Rito and Jörg Jent from Andare, and they graciously took us on a tour of a military shelter, and they're demonstrating the manual drive on a air handling unit. This system here requires, I think, 6 men to operate, but it would provide ventilation for about 1,500 people. So if you had 1,500 people in your shelter, obviously you're going to have a lot of crews available to rotate through operating the air pump. Next slide. This is an older slide taken from a World War II era shelter. The Swiss can deploy their entire population underground in a few hours' notice, and they can also blow every tunnel and bridge leading into their country in 20 minutes. So next time you go visit, Switzerland, it's kind of interesting to bear that in the back of your mind. These people can seal off their country in less than half an hour, and I also would like to highlight the fact that Switzerland has not fought in a war in several hundred years. So whatever they're doing as far as foreign policy seems to be working if the goal is to avoid war. Let's go with the next one. These are the corrugated steel shelters that Sharon and I have been working hard on for the last 20 years. This one is going into a barn, and we kind of like this insulation because half of the shelter is inside the barn where it has a steel hatch entrance, and the emergency exit, I think, in the shows in the next slide, maybe not. What do we have on the next one? Well, doesn't show the detail. The emergency exit is located outside the barn, so if the building were to collapse and burn, if evacuation of the shelter became necessary at any point, the family could emergency egress the shelter and be outside the debris field. Let's go with another one. You can see here that the procedure is fairly straightforward. We merely dig a trench about 20 feet deep, place a 10-foot diameter shelter in the bottom, bed it correctly in crushed rock, and attach the entryways, backfill using correct procedures, and pour the concrete around the hatch assemblies, and you're basically done. It goes in about 5 or 6 days, depending on the competency of the crew that you have, and it's quick and easy. It's much cheaper and much less hassle than building and pouring a concrete shelter. Go with another one. Here is the steel hatch assembly, which we think is a great way to go because it avoids damage from flying debris and reflected overpressures that vertical doors are challenged by. And it also has the ability for the occupants to rescue themselves with simple hand tools and a jack. Another slide. The inside of the shelter provides comfortable accommodations. This one can accommodate about 30 people. We have bunks for 15, and we have hammocks for another 15 people. And of course, individuals can also sleep on the floor, the tables, or whatever. The dining table that you see here is foldable and will store underneath the bench-type bunks that you see here. About 6 adults can comfortably play cards or board games or whatever and eat, consume meals here. And then the table can be folded up and it goes away. Also, your bulky food preparation equipment can be stored in the deep boxes located under the bench seat there. Let's go with the next one. Here we have an individual, a physics teacher actually, from the local university demonstrating the hammock system in the shelter. Approximately 14 hammocks can be strung at one time in the shelter all down the aisleway and still provide reasonable activity space for the other occupants of the shelter. And there's a little bit better view of the bench-type arrangements on the bunks there. The electrical system on the inside is provided by 12-volt DC storage batteries and can function for several months without recharging the batteries if that were required. Next slide, please. This is the heart and lungs of the entire system. It's the VA-150. Marianne has shown operating this here. It's amazing how many complaints I get from men who are investigating shelters who whine and ask the question, you mean I have to turn that handle to get air? And our response is, no, you can ask your wife to do that if you're unable to accomplish that. We haven't had anybody tour the shelters that we have in Utah that have claustrophobic issues or anything like that. They've all been very comfortable down there. We think the best time to take tours down in the shelters is on a day like today when it's about 115 outside or 100 degrees outside in the shade. And when you go down inside the shelter, it's about 63 degrees and it feels wonderful. And, of course, the dead of winter when it's about 10 below zero is another great time because it's nice and warm in there comparatively, and the only thing you really need to wear in a shelter is a sweatshirt. I think what we're trying to get people to do here is to recognize the need for protecting one's own family, because it's going to be a long, long time, I think, before the government does anything toward that end. And so we encourage you to seek out that opportunity. And if you don't use any of our systems, we would certainly hope that you would do something to improve the readiness of your family. Next slide, Trey. This is just another view from the other end that gives you a little bit better detail on the bunks. The bunks have a folding membrane on top that enables you to store all your personal items, hygiene equipment, so forth, in your own bunk, and makes for a neat, clutter-free environment. I think Sharon is going to focus a little more on EMP issues.
We could, rather than change spots completely, maybe we'll just kind of do this portion together, but I did want Paul to comment on the cost of a national shelter system.
Back in the mid-80s, the cost was determined to be around $75 billion in 1985 dollars, and today, of course, with inflation, the cost would probably approach $150 billion, which is still about three and a half months of the Pentagon's annual budget. I think the Defense Department is now spending about $460 billion a year, if my figures are correct, on defense. And, of course, a shelter system would be a one-time expenditure, and then, you know, things would the cost to own would, of course, deteriorate rapidly from there.
I think we only have about 7 minutes left, so rather than go into any of the weapons effects, we thought we'd kind of pick up time if people wanted to know more about EMP and practical measures to actually withstand this function. But I think if anyone has questions, please feel free to ask the questions.
While the questions are forming out there, I might mention that there has been some discussion in the press lately about Iran's efforts to perfect their Shahab-3 intermediate-range ballistic missile for use in carrying a nuclear weapon over the United States. They have been launching these missiles from freighters in the Caspian Sea and exploding them at very high altitudes downrange, and they've been testing their fusing systems. And so a lot of national security experts are very alarmed at this because they feel that they are preparing to do an EMP laydown on the continental U.S. From a coastal launch from an old tramp steamer. And, of course, once the launch is completed and the missile is on its way, they can just sink the steamer. And, of course, there would be no evidence as to the origins of the launch. Of course, we'd have no way of knowing who to retaliate on at this point. But a single EMP laydown in such a manner would cripple the United States for an undetermined period of time and would make us a third world country. Yes, sir.
I'm not only an American, I'm also a Swiss citizen and used to be in the Swiss Army. So I'm well aware of civil defense problems. One thing I would like to point out, though, have you considered the fact that if you have to spend not hours, but days, weeks in such a shelter,
yes,
you're going to have a problem, A, with getting rid of the heat and getting rid of the humidity?
Very good points. Now, we have practiced shelter occupancy tests in Utah in our own shelters, and one of the advantages of the steel hull is that it conducts body heat through to the surrounding earth quite well. And actually, the body heat is kind of a plus for a while because in the wintertime, it warms things up to a nice temperature. But, of course, the primary way of dealing with excess body heat is through ventilation, and I'm sure you're very aware of that. But the Swiss have handled that very well.
And we have taken our families into these shelters and spent some time there, and it's a slightly different way of life. But now when my grandkids come, they all say, "Grandma, can we have a slumber party in the bomb shelter?" They think it's a great place to play. But we feel very comfortable in our shelters, and the steel is actually a very good heat sink. Concrete is a little harder to cool, but our steel shelters are very comfortable.
And we would like to talk to you after the meeting.
One complaint that we have had, and we like to offer this suggestion, we have had a concern, people say, well, if there's a terrorist attack, and of course the likelihood of terrorist attack is very large, how do you know when to get into your shelters? Your shelters won't do you any good if you don't know when. But our answer to that problem is that possibly some of us will be caught unawares with the blast problem. But the radiation effect is very insidious, and we will have time to get in to cover ourselves from any radiation. And also, we would immediately go into our shelters if there were a chemical biological concern. If there were smallpox any place in the United States, we would self-quarantine immediately. And if there was a possibility of a laydown of the biological, we would have our filters ever present. But we feel that these shelters are a great solution. And in the middle of the night, in the middle of the winter, you have an earthquake. If you can get out of your home, you can go into that shelter. You have your food, your clothing, your communications, your warmth. You just go to bed and deal with it in the morning. So they are all-hazard shelters.
How much is one of your 20-foot shelters completely equipped, including installation?
I don't have my price sheet right here, but I'm guessing a 20-foot by 10-foot diameter shelter would run approximately $25,000. Installation.
Just happen to have a price.
Oh, Sharon.
We're hoping that people will go a little higher than a 20-foot. A 30-foot is a good size. An 8 by 30, around $34,000. A 10 by 50, around $45,000. So you see, there's not a whole lot of difference between our smallest and our largest shelters. And we can make them much larger than that as well. But what we're figuring with 50 people maximum in these shelters is that the shelter price per place is around $800 or $900 a person. And we feel like that's a very reasonable place if you're using maximum occupancy. But we can design these to any size. We customize every shelter. We put them together in various configurations. We can make them small, we can make them large. But we always try to put the two entrances and small diameter entrances with 90 degree turns.
Installation usually runs between $5,000 and $7,000, unless you have special unique problems on your job site, like huge rocks or something. But we'll go ahead and release the podium.
Thank you so much for staying on Sunday morning.
Thank you. Why don't you